make comments. And in preparation to that, I suggest that we look at the differentiation between meditation and meditation practice. When we do the practice that we just did with Ari, or that you've done with other teachers, we are practicing meditation so that we can really be in meditation every moment of our lives. And so the big question really is, how can we bring meditation into every moment of our lives in a way that is alive and that works for what needs to happen in that moment of life? And that's really the discovery that takes the meditation practice to its potential. And so I suggest that we now practice in something that is a little closer to normal life than just sitting with closed eyes, which is to be here with open eyes, be in contact with each other. And I'm here speaking, and I sense my body as I do that, and I feel my breath, and I feel my feelings, and there are thoughts going on, and all that can somehow be in my awareness, and I can still more or less coherently speak. Right? Because the speaking can arise from a place that in a way responds to the situation and to a whole lifetime. And so you could check like how it was for you in the break, whether you were mindful the whole time as fully as you are maybe now or as you were during the meditation, or if not, why not? Is it difficult, or does it seem not useful? Or whatever the reason, we won't drill down in great detail, but I think it is important to see, like, there might be something to be discovered about the usefulness for you personally. If you are not feeling you want to cultivate it, and this has nothing to do with any judgment at all, because as you know, the Buddha said that if you want to know yourself, you really need to accept and love yourself and not judge yourself. Because only then will you really be able to fully see what's happening inside of you. So now maybe let's look a little bit at listening, right? So I'm speaking, and you can see how much you are kind of receiving my words, kind of letting them travel to you, rather than kind of reaching out towards me. In a way, there's nothing you need to do to listen, except for sensing yourself. But as children, our parents are so important that we get trained to kind of join the other, to merge with the other, to focus on the other when we're listening, and we keep that habit. But we can bring it back, and when we bring it back and actually listen, sensing our whole experience, then we can more easily be mindful of how it affects us, right? Does it make sense to you in your mind what I'm saying? So the mind responds in some way. Do you like me or not? You know, these are all things that are happening as responses in the body right now. The more we are aware of them, the more we have choice on how to act or not from them. So when Ari said about getting angry, you know, we can, we're really listening and we're sitting inside and we feel the anger arise, we can be with it. We don't have to unconsciously act from it. So as we go through the rest of the evening, let's just, if you want to, play with how is it to listen sitting totally in yourself and paying special attention to you, also maybe listening to what we say, but not predominantly. But predominantly really be with yourself and how what is said by others and us is impacting you. And then that is a practice that we can take in our lives. And you can just play how it is when you sit with people and you just really there, sit with them and you sit in yourself and you feel your breath and your presence and nothing needs to happen. And they can just be exactly the way they are. They don't have to please you, they don't have to say the right thing. It can be so amazing to have somebody in one's life that listens like that. And so that's the what I'm very interested in my work, having done spiritual and psychological teaching for 25 years now, how to bring it into work in the world with social entrepreneurs and business people and political leaders and activists and all kind of people who somehow want to make a difference in the world, which is not easy. And that's how I got recruited by Ari. I was in New York, and he had saw a book that I co-authored called Leadership is Global, and we were having tea, and then at the end of the tea he said, "You have to come to Sri Lanka." Right? And what I think is interesting is to see that there is a Buddhist country, a country in which many people think of themselves as Buddhist. And there's this incredible organization, you know, having wonderful leadership. And yet also in that organization, there is a lot to learn about how to integrate the depths of understanding that Buddhism has to offer with the functioning in the world. So there, for example, all the meetings start with meditation. But some people actually practice, and I think some people maybe just been planning what they're going to do in the meeting. You know? Because it's difficult to discover meditation and to really bring it into functioning. And so there are some people in the organization that are the microcredit bankers, and they are very socially engaged and they want to make a difference, and they're also bankers. They have to make loans available and they have to get the money back. And then there are, so they're a little bit more in the business field, and then there are more the social change people and the service people. And there is a certain cultural divide between them. So there is, like for us, there's something to bridge there and to learn from each other. And they're also still discovering that. And what I think is important, I mean, when I was sitting here, it's like, it's always a little strange to sit up for me on a pedestal. Because I think the key teaching of Ari and of Savonia is that they have supported the villagers that are socially incredibly disempowered. And of course certain people in the village even more, the lower caste people, women, children, so forth. There are all kind of hierarchies. for them to discover that they each can make a difference. For the village to see, like, rather than waiting for the government to build a road, that they can build it together and that they can cooperate across the divides of society and gender and generation. And in the functioning together can make a real difference, and afterwards they don't only have a road. They have really discovered themselves as a more empowered human being and as a more empowered community. And so building one road is in a way a lifetime of empowerment and a lifetime of processes of how to continue to grow. And I think that's so beautiful. I think what is important is that we each in our lives, I mean, we all are incredible human beings and we all have incredible gifts, but I think we often don't necessarily trust that or find a way to express that. And I think that's what we want to support also in our writing together. And we are writing about Buddhist economics and leadership, of how this inner work and outer work can be brought together to inspire all of us to be engaged and to use that engagement as practice so that the service can deepen our practice and the practice can deepen our service. And in that we can be together. We can overcome, which I think is something hard to understand in many countries of the global south, the incredible loneliness and this kind of deep sense of separation that's so predominant in the north of the world. Yeah, so we are in this dialogue together about how to bring this richness of experience into a form that's useful. And so being with you and hearing what you have to say and the questions that you have and the comments that you evoke in us is also really helpful to us in making this happen. So in some way, we are all writing this book together. And so we thank you for that. And maybe that's a good time to start hearing your questions and comments, and then we can respond to that.
Dr. Ari, thank you for being here and welcoming me. I would just like to ask a question about how to remember to access the power of my breath when I'm the most upset. Is there any way to, like, because it's very powerful and effective, but oftentimes I forget.
Can you repeat it?
Repeat it?
Yeah.
Yeah, how she can remember to be aware of her breath, because sometimes the emotion is very powerful.
Yeah. I had a good friend, an old lady. She was forgetting everything. So she tied round her neck things that she has to do. But then one day she said she forgot to look at that all. Therefore, these are human weaknesses we all have. Even I sometimes, now I can easily get 100,000, 200,000, even more, up to 950,000 I have tried, just to keep absolutely silent. And then guide them through a particular meditation process. And all of them who participate observe how this mind energy which we generate together even puts everything. The birds that sing stop singing. Trees that, by wind when they stop. The drivers who drive cars without knowing that something is happening here, they don't blow their horns, you know. Whole area becomes silent, completely silent. So by silencing our minds and bringing it to a particular level, that silence could influence those who are not within that particular, say, community, congregation or assembly. So participating in group meditation helps very much. Because then you know at this time or on this day I have to go. So that helps you to remember. Sometimes, as a young fellow, I asked a very venerable, very highly educated monk, I have this problem of getting up in the morning at 5 o'clock. Even if I put an alarm, I don't get up. He said, you give 5 knocks like this before you go to bed and get up. Even today I do it. It works. This, I was maybe 12 years when he taught me that, now I am 78. You know, so it's practice. I think it is practice. But it's a good habit. No, I am angry now. Look at the breath. Because these 6 faculties we have, including the mind, say my eye catches an object. It may be a living object. Say a young man sees a young lady and falls in love. What happens? There is the eye, there is the object, then something happens in between. Immediately, that person should understand my eye had a contact, created a sensation. This sensation created a perception, I recognize this as somebody that I like. Then a thought came, how nice if we can get married or fall in love. Then this thought go into the consciousness. So 5 things happen instantaneously. Similarly, when you hear something, these 5 things, contact, sensation, perception, volition and consciousness going into the, these things happen. Similarly, from smell or taste or touch or even the mind itself. So when you know that 6 senses with 5 stages like this, 6 into 5, 30, things are happening every moment. When you practice over a long period of time, you can bring your senses under control. So why we always do this anapanasati or there are other forms is because when you concentrate on breathing in and out, if anything comes to the eye or ear or nose or tongue or body or the mind itself, say, go away. Thank you for reminding me that I left my key on the door when I came here. Burglars will come and steal. Forget that. Let burglars come and do anything. You know, these Christian fathers, after the Roman Empire, they preferred to go to the desert. So these desert fathers taught some excellent lessons to us, these monks, Christians. Say, thieves come and take everything away, tie them up, take everything away. When they get up and untie themselves, They find something that it was not stolen. These fathers take it and run to the thieves and say, please, you have forgotten this. Those fellows bring it back. You know, so in spiritual practice, it's amazing how the very things that you expect a reaction, completely different response comes from that person. This is the advantage of a meditative mind. Very difficult, but once you practice, it's so easy.
I think on a practical note, you know, I think many people, especially also in the world of action that I work with, that want to integrate inner work into their functioning, they think like they could start the practice in the middle of the crisis. Right? That's why we have to do it every moment of the day, so that when the crisis arises, then it's so much a habit to be present in the body and in the breath that it can withstand the onslaught of the crisis. Right? And there are ways to remember. So, for example, many people around the world and many cultures use beads. Right? So when I talk, since maybe 25 years, and I give a lot of presentations and teachings and whatever, I always use beads. And so I don't get caught up in the interaction. There's always something that reminds me. My body is here. My breath is here. My heart is here. I can feel you. I can be with you in a human way. We can also talk.
Dr. Ari, nice surprise to see you here tonight. And you always make me laugh about difficult things. So I want to ask you this question. I have been thinking about Sri Lanka quite a bit lately, and you came to my mind much during that time period. And as I thought about the end of the war and the violence and the separation of the people, I had a strong desire to, you know, find out more, and I feel like I know little about the situation, but I did hear firsthand testimonies from people who I then called up, and it sounds like a very difficult situation. And now, being here with you, I feel some lightness of heart. And in thinking about you, I just thought, wow, I wonder how this is for him and also for the people. So I'm not sure I know exactly what my question is, but it's something about that kind of seed of hope and that kind of lightness of spirit or depth of sight. And how you maintain that in these difficult times.
Now there are four words of Buddha. Dhammo, have rakkhati dhammachari, that's Pali language. Those who are righteous. Am I right? The English word, righteous.
Righteous.
Those who are righteous will be protected by righteousness. Now, like having faith in an external being, a god or something like that. Now, I have absolute faith in righteousness, dharma. So, I know that I will not violate dharma for any reason. Therefore, fear gets out of me. Because fear is an emotional state that you get along with three other states of mind. One is mental alienation. When I separate you from me or they from us, naturally the mind gets divided. That's called chanda. That is mentally getting alienated from other people. That is how caste, race, religion, all the differences are created. When that kind of mental separation takes place, what happens? There is an ill will that comes. Not straight away you get an ill will, but you first feel, I am a Buddhist, he is a Christian, so I have nothing to do with that person. Or he is a Buddhist, I am a Christian. That kind of alienation comes first. It slowly develops into ill will, hatred and even war. Just imagine, those who worship the same God in the Middle East, Muslims, they were fighting each other. They are fighting. In my country also, I was about to rush to that place when somehow somebody interfered. I don't know whether it was the military or anybody, settle it. Same, the people who profess the same religion, but two sects fighting, setting fire to a mosque or something like that. In my country, this happened about 6-7 months ago. So, when you are mentally, when you divide, alienated from other people, that slowly develops into an ill will. Then fear. So you raise your walls between your two houses and have security and locks and all that kind of thing. Fear. You don't stop there. Unfortunately, we have a system of education where all ignorance in the world are scientifically organized and call it education. Do you know, understand what I say? That is, organized ignorance is called education in most places. A sociologist. Now in my villages where I am working, I have made those village people forget that they belong to a particular caste or race or religion or anything of that sort. You are members of the human family. As members of the human family, we have this body-mind combination which have to be always kept healthy, alive, evolving, creating like that. A sociologist goes, what's your caste? What's your husband's caste? Your children are married to what caste? They bring these divisions back. For what? In the name of scholarship. This is bad. This is happening. So fourth thing is ignorance. So these four things work together. Buddha called them four evils. Chanda, mental alienation. I don't know the correct English word. I think we can get Jack to tell us the right word. Then chanda, dvesha, ill will. Bhaya is fear. Moha is ignorance. So we have to attack all these four. Then only we can expect some kind of peace in our minds as well as in society. So, the opposites are metta, that is loving kindness. When, say, we have a problem there, where there are 1,000 people not having clean water to drink, I appeal to you, come next Sunday, come together with whatever tools you can carry, with food packets, not only for you and another person, come there, we'll work, dig wells. So I appeal to your loving kindness. Come with loving kindness. Metta. That loving kindness is put into compassionate action. By digging well is a compassionate action now. So it's different from chanda dvesha. It is metta karuna. When you dig the well and come home sweating and soiled your clothes, everything, tired, but you are still very happy. I have dug a well. I may never go and drink that water, it's for the poor families. Yesterday I met a gentleman who said, I want to construct wells and water services for 200 million people in the world. I said, I'll undertake for 2 million in my country. Easily. So, when you do that, so you get a joy out of it. That's called detached, dispassionate, altruistic kind of joy called mudita. Buddha called it mudita. Metta, karuna, mudita. So when you do this work, some clever people will say, look, in this age of bulldozers and diggers, those fools go and dig wells with bare hands. In this age of industrialization and machinery, they don't understand machines have no brains. They don't understand when we get together and work, there's comradeship, community, love, so much of interaction, so much of human qualities that spring up. So, these four qualities, metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, loving kindness, compassionate action, dispassionate joy, and equanimity are the four principles that awaken a human being as opposed to the earlier four principles. These are Buddha's words, not mine. That is what Buddha told us. Get rid of those four and develop this. If you can develop that, he said, you are exalting yourself to a divine status, he called it, Brahma Viharana. That is, in that society at that time, the Brahma, the highest evolved beings, live in that state with these four qualities. So humans can be divine if you practice this.
Thank you. I come from Germany and I can't so good speak English. I think you can also. Und ich erlaube mir auf Deutsch zu sprechen.
Okay, I translate.
Ja, danke sehr.
She's from Germany, I'm too.
Ja, ich finde diese Idee zu meditieren auch sehr spannend, aber meine Frage ist vielleicht nicht wirklich an Sie, sondern überhaupt, ist es nicht auch eine Methode, sich auf irgendeine Art ruhig zu stellen, also ähnlich wie wir durch das Medium Fernsehen ruhig gestellt werden.
So her question is whether meditation is also a method to calm ourselves or even numb ourselves, as we can numb ourselves with television.
Ja, und ja, ich habe einfach viele Menschen kennengelernt, die sich in diese Meditation flüchten und dort sehr zu Hause fühlen und sehr komfortabel. Also ich habe hier auch drei Kissen unter mir und bin in einem wunderschönen Raum, der sicher viele Dollar gekostet hat.
Okay. And she feels that she met a lot of people who are maybe escaping and feel very comfortable in the meditation and in a beautiful room like this and sitting on comfortable cushions and finding a way to comfort themselves, but in that movement also escape.
Ja, und meine Frage ist, ist es vielleicht wichtig zu gucken, was kann ich tun? Mein Atem ist etwas, was von ganz alleine funktioniert, worauf ich nicht achten muss. Das ist ein Wunder und ein Geschenk. Mm-hmm.
I haven't understood the question. Ich habe die Frage nicht darin verstanden.
Es ist keine Frage, es ist nur also das, was ich empfinde. Mein Atem ist etwas, was von alleine funktioniert, ohne dass ich darauf achten muss.
And she experiences that her breath is happening by itself and it's a wonderful gift that it just keeps flowing.
Ja, und meine Frage ist, die Lösung für das, was auf dieser Welt gerade passiert, ist vielleicht wirklich daran zu finden, dass Männer und Frauen auf eine gleiche Ebene kommen und Heilung passiert zwischen der weiblichen und der männlichen Energie auf dieser Welt, weil ich sehe immer wieder
dass viel, viel Unterschied ist, egal in welcher Religion oder auf welchem Platz.
Yeah. She sees that wherever she goes and in all kind of different traditions, there is a lot of separation between the feminine and the masculine principle, not only between men and women, but and that she wonders whether by integrating the feminine and the masculine we can help to address the challenges, the many challenges that the world is facing. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for translation.
My pleasure. So it's
sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
You go.
To the last part of the question, first. There were two monks from a distant village. They went to the Buddha and asked, got instructions from the Buddha to meditate. Then they were returning home after getting all these instructions. It was getting dark, and there was a river they had to cross. There had been rain and the water level was a little too high. But still they could wade across, being men, the two monks. It so happened there was a pretty young lady there, unable to cross the river. Now here these two monks are going after meditational instructions. According to that, you can't look at a woman, you know. You can look if you can control your mind and not get any attachment. So the elder monk said, now, let's go. And the younger monk said, no, sir, I don't like to leave that woman here and go because it's dark. So many ferocious animals in this jungle. How can we leave her and go? She will be killed, no doubt, by these beasts. They were having a small discussion. Then the young monk just went and held the woman and waded across the water. Elder monk was shouting, you are carrying a woman, you are carrying a woman, stop it. Then the younger monk kept the woman on the other side of the river and said, I don't know whether it's a woman or a man. I carried 5 elements, which of course was alive. That is what I explained when we started the meditation. I carried these 5 aggregates. I don't know whether it's man or woman. So they went back to their monasteries, to their temples, and both meditated. 20 years later, the news spread around that the younger monk had attained arahant, that is, attained enlightenment. This news go around that monk has attained enlightenment. This news came to the elder monk also. He said, what? That man who carried that woman on his head, he's enlightened? So the young monk went to the senior monk and said, sir, I carried that woman only at that moment. You are still carrying her on her head. So, you know, at a particular stage of meditation, this manhood and womanhood is no longer there. That's why a lot of meditators go to the cemeteries and look at the ashes, the bones and all that. There, can you say these are woman's bones or man's bones? No. So these differentiations are there only up to a particular stage. Beyond that, it's not there. Then meditation, there are many. Even in Buddhist meditation, there are, I think, I have studied 42 kinds of meditation which we have been taught as children. But there may be other forms of meditation, Hindu, Christian, all these people have. So it all depends on what form of meditation you practice. For that we have to go to a meditation teacher, divulge to that person your real personality traits. Say if there is somebody who is very, very stingy, or somebody who gets very angry, or somebody who gets irritated by slightest provocation, like that, then that teacher will say, you do this meditation. So a meditator should always have an experienced teacher to help. Here you have an excellent teacher, and maybe there are several. So do not try experiments which can make people develop mental imbalances. And I have this experience that some people have made meditation a fashion. For example, in the house I had rented in 1960s, the proprietor came one day and said he went for a meditation center. He didn't know that I was silently a meditator myself. You know, I want to sit down and meditate with you. I said, excellent, excellent. Come to my shrine room. We sat down and meditated. He got up, he saw the fan. He said, Ari, can't you increase the rent by 10 rupees? Because the fan was working. He never thought of the fan when he rented. I said, now, the meditation made you 10 rupees greedier. It made me 20 rupees giving up. So, I'll give you 20 rupees. And don't talk about this hereafter with me. And that is the one and the last time I meditated with him.
In answer to your question, I think there is an excellent point that you're making. Can you understand when I speak English? Okay. Is your friend going to translate? I try to give you a slow German answer. You know, it's interesting because the last today and yesterday evening we were at the UC Berkeley Center for Peace and Developing Economies, and yesterday at a conference for Economy of Peace. And there the question of the people many people is, does this spirituality thing really necessary to have peace and to help with economics and, you know, all of human rights? I mean, what's that really good for? And so we try to explain that. But I think in the same way, you could say that in many spiritual communities, action or service isn't fully appreciated for its powerful transformational impact in our spiritual development. We see it not, we might see it as some good thing to do, rather than to see it as a profound practice in which we are continuously confronted with our challenges. And it's true, if we are only sitting in a meditation room doing meditation practice, we are not yet meditating. We are just doing meditation practice. Meditation happens in life. And if we avoid life, we can become maybe good meditators, but we'll never be free. But the purpose of meditation is not that we become a good meditator, but that we become free and compassionate and effective. And I just want to bring something that I was thinking about earlier also, when Jack was talking. In Germany, as you know, we had a terrible and unavoidably terrible past through the Third Reich. And what was maybe most terrifying during the Nazi destruction weren't even, let's say, the egregious acts of violence, but was the absolute cold-hearted bureaucratic functioning that allowed the extermination of millions of people and a huge war machine to function day after day after day after day like Swiss clockwork. And one of the great leaders of that time was called Eichmann. You might know him. There's a wonderful book written about his trial in Jerusalem by Hannah Arendt, which is called The Banality of Evil. And when the team of psychologists from around the world that came to study this incredible guy, I mean, now we're getting our hands on the real person here. They did all the psychological tests that, you know, psychology had developed. And the American psychiatrist who was the leader of this team at the end said, "I have to admit to you that Eichmann is more normal than I am. He is actually more normal than most of the members of my team." So with these tests, we have defined as normality something that is very heartless, and because it's so closed-hearted, it can do whatever is asked of it. It's the machine person. And in a certain way, we are all part of that, because we live in a world that's incredibly destructive, and we somehow keep functioning. We somehow go along. I mean, we maybe in this room, you know, try to do something, but somehow just keeps going. And the world is destroyed, and there are wars, and species disappear, and we are cruel to each other in daily interactions, or we are just not loving to each other in daily interactions. And there was a man who's now also an old man who survived due to this guy Schindler, this very imperfect German business guy who was producing stuff for the army and in the process helped over 1,000 Jews to survive, called Schindler's List, the movie was made. So Zef Kadam, who was one of these children, when I had a long conversation with him, he said at the end, "You know what, besides all the losses of the friends and family and so that I had, of course, the thing that was most precious that I lost and that I've tried my whole life since then to regain is my human sensitivity." It's so hard to cultivate that and to learn to live in this sensitive, open, vulnerable way and to recognize that within it we can be strong and clear. And that's really what the purpose of spiritual practice is about for me, that we do not become such a machine, that we will not be taken over by a system that has a certain way of seeing the world, and before you know it, you're kind of part of that maelstrom of functioning, but that you can stand up and say, "No, this is not right." And if enough of us are doing that, and I think more and more of us are doing that, then we can really change the world. So meditation practice can lead to real meditation in the world, to being really sensitive, open-hearted, responsible people that then act on what's in front of them.
Hello. Actually, that was a really great lead-in to my question, because my question really has to do with how you resolve an unresolvable conflict. Something from your past where there's a judgment on you that you can't fix or change. How do you deal with that, taking that towards your own death, your own...
A little louder, it's a little hard to understand.
Okay. How do you resolve an unresolvable conflict, a judgment from your past that you can't influence or change, even though you've changed and your relationship to how that event unfolded changed? The fact that someone still holds judgment over you and won't allow a resolution to take place, how do you take that to your grave, is kind of my question. How do you resolve that karmically?
I think what we are going to do, considering the time, I think we're going to use this as closing statements also.
I shall be very brief. I remember in 1956, a great saint, a great intellectual, highly respected person in the world at that time, Krishnamurti, was giving a series of lectures for 7 days. I was seated right in front of him at his feet and listening. He was asked this question. He said, "My friend, carefully analyze the problem. Answer to the problem is in the problem itself. There is no conflict that cannot be resolved if you go into the roots of it. The biggest problem that Buddha encountered was unsatisfactoriness or suffering in human life. Birth is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering, parting from the loved ones is suffering, to be associated with people that you don't like is like that. Everywhere you find this unsatisfactoriness, dukkha." And he said, "This is the first noble truth." Then going into the cause for the second noble truth. Why this suffering? Greed, desire. Can it be removed? It can be removed. That was the third noble truth. Fourth noble truth was, yes, there is a way, a noble eightfold path leading to the removal of suffering. Eightfold path, right understanding. I just mentioned, to understand that everything changes every moment, anatta. If you hang on to things that change, whether material or non-material things, invariably dukkha, suffering comes. If it changes, if it brings about suffering, I factor is an illusion. That is right understanding. You can't understand it verbally. You can understand it only by meditative practice and living it. Then when people have right understanding, their thoughts are right thoughts. The words they utter are right words. They will not utter untruth. They will have no harsh words. They will not carry tales. They will not use useless words and gossip and all that. Right words. Their deeds will be right deeds. Their deeds will have nothing to do with killing, stealing, adultery, lying or intoxication. Right deeds. Their livelihood will be right livelihood. Making millions and billions out of armaments, selling intoxicants, selling poisons, drugs, prostitution, killing people, animals, destroying jungles, all these things. Not right livelihood, wrong livelihood. So once you have these five, including right livelihood, then right effort Right effort is you try to keep, preserve, protect whatever good thoughts you have in your mind. Dispel whatever bad thoughts you have in your mind. Bring in new good thoughts into your mind. Don't allow evil thoughts to come to your mind. These four, that mental effort called right effort. When you exercise that right effort, then you can develop right mindfulness. We sit, we stand, we walk, we sleep, lie down. All these postures, if we can do with mindfulness throughout the day, not at the time you sit only for meditation, throughout the day, to the extent that one can develop that in life, to that extent, that person comes closer and closer from right mindfulness to right concentration. It is right concentration that leads to liberation from all suffering, because morality will help for the concentration of the mind, which will help for people to develop their wisdom. Call it Sila Samadhi Prajna, Buddhas. So in actual fact, it's a process beginning with right understanding, going into the causes, removing the cause, and following a path to enlightenment. Such a person will stop creating new energy. Every moment when we create new energy, that means we are born. We die every moment, we are born every moment. One fine day when this body stops functioning and when all the parts are dissolved, it will take another. That energy will go and take another form. But for an enlightened person, that is the end of it. No more karma created, no more energy created. Now in my country, because you raised that question, we are in a situation where all the less enlightened people are very happy. A terrorist war has come to an end. What about those people who died? Their relations, their wives, their children, both from the military and the terrorist side? They are not that happy. They have wounds in their hearts. Now we have a big task, not only for relief and rehabilitation of these people, but at the same time to heal their wounds. To heal their wounds, I spend a lot of time with my colleagues to teach them dharma. Dharma is the only way to bring peace into the minds of people and bring peace to society and also bring peace to our environment. So thank you.
So, maybe also last thing that I want to add to that before we end. Coming back to the Third Reich, which I grew up with and which was the big question when I grew up as a teenager every day for us, how that could happen. And as I started to become engaged in spiritual practice and I heard about the ground of being is love and goodness, I couldn't bring the two things together. How is it possible then, if really the ground of being is love and goodness, that this happens? And it's been my inquiry for 35 years. And what I realized, and I think that's maybe where your question was pointing to, is that paradoxes can't be resolved at the level where they are paradox. You have to find a deeper understanding. You have to find contact, living, vibrant contact and presence of a deeper ground that actually contains the resolution. And in my experience, after having pestered many teachers around the world with this question of how is this possible, and getting invariably the same answer, that there is a fundamentally deeper ground of goodness, in my practice, I also now have not a shadow of a doubt that the fundamental ground of being is goodness and love. But it needs to be discovered, and until it isn't, it's not true. And until then, it's a paradox. And until then, it should be a paradox because it should bother us and prod us on to practice so that we can discover what can be discovered. And now when I look at the world, and there was a lady in the break who said, will you talk about the environment and climate, please? And she didn't raise her arm, or maybe we didn't see her. Anyway, so you can look at the world and you can see this enormous destruction and so much pain and suffering. But what I also see is that in every sector of society, in every society around the world, there is tremendous reform movements happening. This is an incredible reform movement happening right now, that somehow these 300 people come together tonight. We are reinventing medicine, we are reinventing how to do economy, how to bring human rights, how to bridge men and women and discover what it might mean for a man to be a real man and also be feminine, and for a woman to discover what the real woman is. I think we are really discovering a lot of this afresh, and it's happening. And when you look at what happened over the last 50 years in terms of these new movements, it's amazing. It really is amazing. And in my experience, again, there is a dynamic, fundamental force of evolution that includes our enlightenment, that supports us and moves us forward, and that brings up these questions, and that brings up the desire to practice, and that brings up the practices that help us practice. And we can sink into that dynamic movement and look over and over to connect with it, and it will carry us. Now, that might not be true for somebody else, and I totally respect that. I don't want to say that that's something to be believed, because as you know, the Buddha was very much against believing. He said, you know, don't believe me. Practice, find out for yourself. If it's true for you, it's true. If it isn't, it isn't. So, but I just want to share that that's where I am at. I feel this fundamental goodness. I feel this force of evolution. And I feel that we are doing it together. We are the life that is doing this. Thank you.
Shall we?
Yes.
Now we are ending the thing?
Yeah, ending.
We are finishing?
Yeah.
Then before we end, 2 minutes, please be seated. We should not be selfish. For 7:30, 8:30, 9:30, 3 hours we spent, and hardly any bad thoughts came to our mind. Right? During this time, it was all good thoughts that came, good words we heard. That's a great meritorious act. So 3 hours of merit we gathered. So please close your eyes. Silence your mind. Think of those near and dear to you who are no longer living with us. May they get this merit and lead better and higher lives. Then let the entire humanity share this meritorious energy we released and have peace in their minds and peace in their societies. May all those divine beings who are associated with this planet in addition to human beings, may they also acquire this merit and be well and happy and contribute to build peace and happiness to the entire humanity and living world. Thank you.
And if you feel like playing a little bit more together, there is on Wednesday in 2 days another meeting where the two of us get together with the abbot of Green Gulch and the woman who runs the garden, the wonderful garden and farm there, for a dialogue and a question and answer session. So if you're interested, Green Gulch.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.